a result of the passage of time, or my advancing age. While I have taken some literary license with the dialogue, I believe the conversations depicted accurately capture the spirit of the moment. Additionally, I have changed some of the names out of concern over privacy, at the request of the individual, or because I was unable to contact the person in question. Chapter 1. The Greatest Generation. Fontainebleau, France, 1960. I pushed the swinging door open just a crack and peeked out into the large, smoke-filled room. Jean-Claude, the tall young French bartender, was shuttling from table to table, taking drink orders from the American officers who filled the club on a Friday night. Moving through the door, I crawled on my hands and knees to a place just behind the bar. From there, I was hidden from view, but could still see the entire room. The American Officers Club, located in the heart of Fontainebleau, France, was a three-story structure built in the French provincial style, with ornate molding, winding staircases, a small caged elevator, and large oil paintings of Napoleon, Louis XVI, and countless battle scenes. As a child of five, to me the club was a special place. There were banisters to slide down, closets to hide in, and hallways to run through. I roamed freely, imaginary sword in hand, fighting pirates and Prussians, Nazis and Russians. Using the hidden passages inside the building, I could move from the kitchen to the bar completely undetected. The dumbwaiter, which connected the kitchen to the second and third floors, served as a means to slip past the waitstaff, my two sisters, who were charged with keeping me out of trouble, rarely successfully, I might add, my parents, and the scores of other officers who knew I prowled the halls unattended. While it was an American club, officers from every allied nation were welcome. Impressive in their uniforms, straight in their bearing, they had a swagger and a confidence that was unmistakable to the victors of World War II. It had been almost 15 years since the end of the war, but France was still rebuilding, and the Europeans looked to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, to protect it from the Soviets. The military arm of NATO was the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE, to which my father was assigned, and the reason we were living in France. As I moved to the other side of the bar, Jean-Claude spied me and gave me that look, a look I had seen 100 times before. "I see you," it said, but there was always a twinkle in Jean-Claude's eye. Like all men grown older, he appreciated the mischief in a young boy's heart, and I sensed there was a longing to be that lad again. In my mind, Jean-Claude was my protector, the keeper of my secrets, the Watson to my Holmes. Across the room, my father was sitting at an oval table with three other men. They all wore the uniform of an Air Force officer, a collared light blue shirt, a dark tie slightly loosened at the neck, and a deep blue coat with silver wings on the chest. With Dad were Easy Ed Taylor, Wild Bill Wildman, and Gentleman Rod Gunther, all colonels, all fighter pilots. Ed Taylor, his hands in the air, one in pursuit of the other, was fending off an attack from a German Messerschmitt. A cigarette hung loosely from his lips, and he only paused from the story to take a sip from the Scotch snifter at his elbow. Ed was one of the pioneers of jet aircraft, at one point the fastest man in the world in aerial flight. He was Hemingway-ish, with a flair for the dramatic, a love of good whiskey, and a need to fill every minute of life with something exciting. A fighter pilot in World War II in Korea, he would go on to serve in Vietnam and end his career as a three-war veteran. He drank hard, smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes, loved to be in combat, and seemed to enjoy every person he ever met. On his wall at home were personalized pictures with Presidents FDR, Truman and Eisenhower, Generals Douglas MacArthur and George Patton, ballplayers Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris, kings and princes, tyrants and despots, and every average Joe he ever served with. Every picture came with a story. Ed was married to Cordelia, or Cordy, as everyone called her, a southern girl from Texas who served as the Wives Club president and was always in charge of the children's plays and adult social functions. Cordy liked to party as much as Ed, and their marriage, which lasted for over 50 years, was a constant struggle between his love of combat and a domestic